My name is Ray Choate. I'm the University Librarian here at the University of Adelaide, and it gives me great pleasure indeed to welcome you to our library this evening. Before we start, if you have one of these contraptions, being a librarian, I've tried to disguise mine as a book, but it is, in fact, a mobile phone. If you wouldn't mind turning it off, please. I would also at this moment like to acknowledge the Kaurna people who are the original custodians of the Adelaide Plains and the land upon which the University of Adelaide's campus is here at North Terrace, at Theberton and Roseworthy and Waite are built. Now I'd like to ask Kay Baudinette, who is a member of the Friends Committee, if she'd introduce our speaker.
Well, I'm delighted tonight to be able to introduce our speaker, Ian Gibbons, who is someone that I haven't seen for probably 5 or 6 years, but our paths did cross many decades ago and over quite a long period of time. As National Science Week commences on Saturday, I think it's quite fitting that our speaker tonight is an outstanding Australian scientist with a strong international reputation. Ian was born in Melbourne and completed a PhD at the University of Melbourne. And after a couple of years in the US, Ian was appointed to the Department of Anatomy in the medical school at Flinders University. He rose to become professor of that department, and following his retirement earlier this year, he was awarded the status of emeritus professor. Ian's academic specialisation is neuroscience. He has worked on the microscopic structure of nerves that monitor and control the activity of the internal organs, and he's published over 100 scientific papers. These days, Ian has done a bit of a lateral arabesque. He's mainly a poet, an electronic musician, I understand. He's been writing poetry seriously since 2007 and has been shortlisted for major prizes. To quote an excerpt from Ian's own website, "Art and science share much more than they differ. Both aim to explain the world and our place within it." Please join me in welcoming Ian Gibbons.
Well, thank you very much, Kay, and thank you everybody for coming out on a cold night. It's a multiple pleasure to be here talking in the library. As Kay said, we met a long time ago at Flinders, and part of that association is through the library. So when I first started at Flinders in 1984, within about a year or so, I was put on the library committee. And I was on the library committee until about 18 months ago. So most of the time I was at Flinders, I was in some way or other involved with the library there. And so it's really great to be in the library at the other end of town as well. So books and libraries have been a big part of my academic life. So what I'm going to do tonight is sort of a mixture of things, talking about the relationship between writing poetry in particular and science in different ways, in particular neuroscience. So mostly it'll be a bit of stuff about how your brain works and how language works and things like that, but also be a selection of poems too from stuff that I've published, some unpublished stuff as well, which illustrate the various ways in which poetry can work, various ways in which it can mess with your brain in different ways, I suppose, is one way of thinking about it. So we've got plenty of time. I'll just put my watch off so I can keep an eye on it. So one of the things that I like doing it, to make these sessions interactive as possible. So if questions come to your mind as we're going through, you know, stick your hand up or sing out or something, and you know, I might answer it on the spot, or I'll adapt what I'm going to say next, or we'll make a little note to come back to that point. So we don't necessarily have to save them all to the end if we don't want to. So I suppose one question is, oops, got a bit of feedback, is why bother with poetry? And this question came up very explicitly couple of months ago, I was doing a workshop at Australian Science and Math School, not about neuroscience or chemistry or microscopes or something, but about poetry, which was really interesting. And trying to get year 10, 11 kids interested in anything other, I mean, actually anything at all, let alone poetry, was a bit of a challenge. And the first question was come up, you know, why should you bother with poetry? What's it all about? Well, I don't have much of a literary theory in a formal academic sense, but obviously I think about it a bit. And one of the things which makes poetry poetry, I think it's not necessarily rhythm and rhyme, and that's important in certain contexts. It's not necessarily all the imagery and all the rest of it. That's important too. We'll come back about that. But in a way, poetry puts into words things that you don't normally put into words. And some forms of poetry, you can't even say. You can't even speak it out loud. So I think visual poetry, concrete poetry, abstract poetry like that. It looks fantastic on the page, but you don't actually know how to say it. I've done stuff like that where I can't read. I have to get the computer to read it. So poetry can speak the unspeakable or describe the otherwise indescribable in some way or another. And so I'll give you some examples of that as we go through some of my attempts to deal with that. Now, something else poetry can be, which especially the way I tend to do it, is to create some imaginary viewpoint, some way of looking at the world that's new, that perhaps you haven't thought about before, you haven't seen before. And people talk about what's similar between art and science, and that's one thing which is really similar. The ability of art, in this case writing, specifically poetry, to present a view of the world that perhaps no one else has come up with before, if you're really lucky. It takes a fair bit of luck. And that's the same in science. So one of the wonderful things when I was doing my research for over 30 years, mostly as a microscopist, every time we went to the microscope, more often than not, look down the microscope, we see something no one has ever seen in the whole history of life on Earth. That's a pretty good thing to happen every day when you go to work. So good art does the same thing. It presents a view of something. Could be a picture, could be some words, could be some sounds that no one's ever seen before, no one's ever heard before, no one's ever felt before. And that's a really remarkable point of similarity, point of overlap about art and science. But also, something about poetry which I like exploring, which is not so common for, I don't think, for poetry, is I like making stuff up. I like seeing poetry as fiction, not necessarily a expression of my inner self or something like that. That's that too, you can't help in that. But I just like making stuff up and telling stories. And poetry gives a way of telling a story in a very, very compressed way, an oblique way, an ambiguous way, which I think mimics a lot of way if we interact with the world. So why don't we start with a story which... it's got elements of truth in it, but it's not actually true. But it's built from experience. So it's a science poem in a way. It's called Conference Leave. And one of the great joys of being in academic life is that you actually get paid to go overseas and do good things, like go to conferences, which hopefully will illuminate you, make a new network of friends, friends, I might turn out to be relatives. What I'm trying to think of. Associates, researchers, collaborators who become a network around the world. You've probably all guessed, sometimes other things go on at conferences too. So conference leave. All blank, all white, inhaling jellyfish, coughing up thylacines. My best intentions entangle, disentangle, bleach to silicon dust. Scrub to translucency, my equilibrium fails, both scabby knees bleed. Below the exit sign, you sit, head in your hands, ringlets loose across the nape of your neck, almost prehistoric, with neither gold chain nor pearls. Your pinpoint idols, uncommitted, no longer blue, abandons vacant Cartesian grids. A sketch, our awkward pharmacology, three knocks at the door, counterposed, an illusion of sirens, fire alarms, shaking bamboo blinds, flashlights, parquetry. Was it something I said, failed to mention, never considered? Elizabeth, passport's valid. I know a dozen popular songs. My data have been analysed. Finally, the statistics are complete. In an atmosphere of collaboration, I offer you tiger lilies, coconut oil, analgesia. Beyond our continental drift, the numbness you covered, a license to misfold mountain ranges, to encourage clamber and trip and tumble. Each success, every loss tallied in fossiliferous shale, the search and destroy we run together. Covered by distance, you fade from view. Join the assembled throng. Isobars embroider your back. Threats of extinction encircle your thighs. And one of us must blush. Without prompts, one of us must look down. Can anybody tell if this is an affair of the heart? Coalescent desire, a simple diversion. Where are our aims, our experimental plans, our predicted outcomes? All blank. Formalities are complete. All white. I take to the podium and begin to speak. So, thank you. No need to clap. So, that gives you an idea of the way I write. But also, that was an example where there's all bits of stuff in there. There's stories about science, there's using some scientific language, formal names of animals like thylacines, for example. This was actually published in Cordite and the Poetry Journal, and it was about, the title was Gondwanaland, Gondwana. So the history of life on Earth, continental drift, things moving around, building mountains as India crashes into Asia to make the Himalayas. So there's allusions to all of that in there as well. So a science poem, or a scientifically oriented poem, can actually have all sorts of background in there that you wouldn't necessarily have otherwise. So what does this mixture of poetry and science offer each other? What can science offer to poetry? Well, one thing is it's a unique worldview. I mean, as a scientist, especially as someone from a biological background, I can't help seeing the world in a particular way. I mean, even if I don't know stuff, I know someone else out there does. And all the different plants and animals that I see around me, a lot of them I do know their names, especially in this area. I know their relationships, I know their evolutionary history, and I can't escape that. That's the way I see stuff. And because I've done a broad science background, I've been teaching science for a long time, I do know a bit about geology and physics. I do know a bit about astronomy and stuff like that. And if I don't, I know what I don't know. And I know that's when I know the difference between making something up and actually using a proper reference. And that's an important sort of thing. Something else that science does too is to give you a massively expanded vocabulary, as does any specialty for that matter. And people always go on about the jargon in science. Well, you get all these words, you know all this stuff, you find all these things you've never seen before, you've got to tell someone about it. You make up stuff. You make up names. And then the process of formalization of these nomenclatures become the sort of official language, if you like, of science. A lot of it's based on Latin and Greek roots. A lot of it's just bad mongrel words that people make up. Sometimes they're not much more than slang that become part of the lexicon. But as a scientist, you have this large specialised language that you have access to. I'll come back to that point again in a moment. And then science as an enterprise has a huge source of material. There's all the people have been working in and around science for hundreds of years now. There are lots and lots of stories there. There are lots of biographies. There are lots of social interactions. There are lots of fairly sordid histories in some cases as well. I'll give you some examples of that. Science, of course, has strong explanatory power. This is how the world works, at least how we think the world works. And sometimes poetry can help to explain something you know from science, but maybe explain it in a better way or a different way. And I'll give you some examples of that. And finally, the amount of stuff which is written in science is enormous. So a few years ago when I started writing again, I thought I'd join the South Australian Writers' Centre, and they asked, so what have you published so far? So, well, you know, three or four poems. But I've published a lot of scientific papers, and when I worked out how many words that was, it was equivalent to about two fat novels worth of stuff. I thought, that probably qualifies me as a writer. And to this day, one way in which a student will not get their higher degree in science is if they can't write. You still have to be able to write well in science to get on. That's true for just any part of it. So as we go through, I'll read some poems, do some poems, and expand some of these examples. Why don't we have an example of worldview? And this is one from my first book, Urban Biology, which came out a couple of years ago now, published by Wakefield Press and Friendly Street Poets. And beautiful cover here is by Judy, sitting in the front. She drew that. And I was surprised when I was looking through to get prepared for tonight, I always surprised myself just how many sciencey sort of poems there are in here. In the back, I mentioned the language that we, and knowing all the different types of things. There's a checklist in the back here of the flora and fauna, which are mentioned in the poems, and there's 140 odd names or something there. Not all of them are named formally in the poems, but I know which ones they are. If I'm talking about an owl and I'm on Kangaroo Island, I knew which one it was. And so it's names in the back of the book, even if it wasn't mentioned in the poem. So let's go to example of a worldview. So I said before, science gives you a way of talking about stuff in a particular way because you know this is what oxygen does, this is how your heart works, this is what blood does, this is why blood's red, that sort of stuff. You know that sort of stuff. But also you can make up a viewpoint. And this is a poem which is one of my favourites and people seem to like it, so if you've heard it before, I hope you won't mind hearing it again. It's called The Science of Shark Fishing. And the question is, it's very controversial again at the moment over Western Australia about sharks. I spend most of my time when I'm not on land in the water, surfing, windsurfing and stuff. And sharks are always there. They might bite me one day, but bad luck. So we need to turn around the other way though. We kill orders of magnitude more sharks than sharks kill people. If you grew up in Melbourne like we did, when you go and get fish and chips down the local fish and chip shop, if you don't specify the fish, what you're eating is shark. So I've eaten a lot of sharks. So what do the sharks think about it? So the only bit of science you need to know for this is that what makes your blood red is hemoglobin. And if you ever taste blood, get a blood nose, a cut mouth or something, what's it taste like? What's blood taste like? Salt, yeah, and something else. Yeah, iron. It tastes sort of steely. And that's the heme, hemoglobin. Heme is iron. There's iron in hemoglobin. That's what makes it red. That's the science. That's all the science you need to know for this. So the science of shark fishing. There's not much you can do with a hook through your jaw. Apart from anything else, you cannot escape that pervading taste of metal, that disorienting, somehow worrying sensation of stainless steel mixed almost certainly and against all hope with your very own pulsating hemoglobin. It's difficult to describe your disbelief and indecision. The pressure is unrelenting. Even in those moments when you convince yourself to relax, to let yourself drift forwards a body length or two, back a metre or two, while refracted ripple skies continue to be drawn just that much closer to your touch. In the end, weariness utterly overwhelms you. Surrounded by more oxygen than you ever have required, you find yourself aching for one more breath of the sea. You wish, perhaps, that evolution had provided you the wherewithal not only to bite, to maul and harangue, but simply, decisively, just to get up and run away. So that was after a picture that was in the advertiser a little while ago. So something else which is a way of using the language of science is to take the Latin roots of the words. So especially in anatomy, where I taught a long, long time, everything's got a Latin name. Why? Because that the science of anatomy developed in medieval, after that, Renaissance times, and Latin was the language of scholarship. And some of the Latin names for parts of the body are just the same words that the Romans would have used. Manus for hand, talus for ankle, that's what they called them. Brachium for arm. But a lot of the compound, complicated words were made up by the anatomists, describing how these parts of the body either looked or worked or the relations between each other. One of the things which used to be one of the biggest challenges teaching anatomy is trying to get the students to get the precision of this language of anatomy, because if you couple the syllables wrong, it's the wrong bit. And if you're telling a radiologist where to take the x-ray, if you get the bits the wrong way around, you might take the x-ray in the wrong spot. Or if the radiologist inverts the words or puts the wrong syllable in, the surgeon might go looking in the wrong spot. Now, those instances, I have to say, are rare, but there are accounts of it happening. So one way of looking at it, one way of trying to learn all this stuff is to actually go back to what the words mean and understand what they mean. And they often give you a good clue. You can get inside the heads of the old anatomists and say, oh, yeah, that's not a bad reason to give me that name. It does actually look like that, or it does do that, or it does sound like that, or something like that. So I've done a few pieces where taken the anatomical terms, taken back to what they originally meant, and then reimagine what it might mean. So this is from a sequence. This sequence is called a skeleton of desire, and it's based on the bones of the forearm. So it's the radius, which is this forearm bone there, ulna, and then the bones of the wrist. You've got two rows, row of three and a row of four. And this isn't an anatomy lecture, but it matters for the point. So you've got scaphoid, which means the little boat. Then it's the lunate, which means the shape like a moon, which it is. Then it's the triquetral, which means having three corners, the triangular. And then you've got the trapezium, which means shaped like a trapezium. The trapezoid, which means almost but not quite shaped like a trapezium. Then the capitate, which is the biggest one, the boss, the capital. And then you've got the hamate, which means having a little hook, which it does. Then there's the pisiform, shaped like a P. And then you've got your metacarpals, the bones of your hands, and then the phalanges of the fingers. That's all the anatomy you need to know for tonight. So, this is the skeleton of desire. I'm not going to go through the names of the bones again. You may have not remembered them. Geographic projections, we expand, contract. The simple effect of gravity, how fast do we spin? The support we require, if not unhinged, disarticulated by the storm surge or thunderbolt or mistimed apprehension. And so we drift. We float on fish-scale seas, a haircloth sail luffs across dry bleached charts. Tidal, countertidal, or even if the mood strikes, just dropping almost within reach. As in the eternal, the stress strains the focal point to find a shifting, caustic spot. Are you with me? Then we swing parabolic, blindsided through illusionary freefall until grasp trusted returns. This is not the same. This is not the way it happens. We are not the same. We too have changed. A sense of safety, perhaps an arch overhead. Neither rainbow nor stone. Neither text nor hollow promise. And in moments of bliss, as oceans embrace us, we skitter away, diaphanous, glittering beyond capture. Now nectar, now honey, at last an anchor point, earth redolent with potential. Bountiful, our landed harvest, our wish for summer, seeds, grains, pulses, monocot, dicot, sheer windlessness. A decision, a memorial, is this what awaits us? How long do we go? How long? A click, a final farewell. So, thank you. As I said before, there's a lot of people in science as well. And people sometimes think of science as being an abstract sort of thing, but it's people doing science. And the social framing of science varies immensely. And it's very, very hard to imagine what it must have been like being a scientist maybe even 100 years ago, 1914 or something, let alone 200 years ago, 1814, or 300 or 400 years ago, practicing what we would now call science. It's very, very difficult to get your head around what it must have been like working in that environment. As professor of anatomy, I got interested in the history of anatomy. And what a sordid tale that is. If we get another couple of hours, I could fill them in on all the ins and outs. You know, all these stories you've probably heard made movies about body snatchers and grave robbers and burking and murders in pubs. Yes, folks, it all happened. And I was the proud inheritor of that tradition. I'm happy to say it doesn't work like that now. But I got very interested in the social construction of medicine, how the way of the medical profession came about, and all of the various social interactions which came part of that. Just as a little aside into that, my brain's just completely faded out. It'll come to me in a moment. Wakefield was part of he did legislation in England, which led to trying to stop grave robbing, but led to the development of body snatchers. So it's pretty good. Now, that's all by way of saying, as teaching anatomy, I used to teach dissection, the body. Real from the body donors, fantastic program coordinated through the University of Adelaide here, just around the corner. And one of the things we're interested in is, how did all this start? How did this come about? And it's an idea which has been researched a lot, and the story is absolutely fascinating. It turns out that one of the first recorded dissections in the modern age was done by a group of nuns, of their mother, the mother superior, in the convent where they were working. And the Abbess Chiara in Montefalco in 1308 died, and she claimed, while she was alive, to have been visited by Christ and had been asked by him to hold his cross for perpetuity in her heart. And then she performed some miracles, and then she was up for beatification or going to be a saint. And in one of the first, probably the first accurately recorded example of someone doing essentially an autopsy, the church required some physical evidence of that she had the cross of Christ in her heart. So the sisters dissected her. And guess what they found in her heart? They found a cross. If you know your heart anatomy, it's not very surprising, because the heart's divided into four chambers by the septum. But this is all very well documented, and The sisters preserved a body using the way they preserved their fresh meat. And if you're in Italy in the 1300s, how do you preserve your meat? The same way as you do now, with olive oil and vinegar and spices. So the first bit of this story is a quote from Sister Francesca of Foligno in 1318, when she reported on this, what they did as part of the inquiry into whether or not Abbess Chiara should be beatified or not. So this is what Sister Francesca said in 1318, in translation. Her body should be preserved on account of her holiness and because God took such pleasure in her body and heart. After Vespers, or thereabouts, the said Francesca, Margherita, Lucia and Caterina went to get the heart, which is in a box. They put it in a box. And the said Francesca of Foligno cut open the heart with her own hand, and opening it, they found in the heart a cross, or an image of the crucified Christ. That got her sainted. So, but what were the sisters thinking? How could they do this? Cutting open a body of anybody is hard enough, but if it's been your abbess and she's going for study, how do you do it? Well, this is managing that story. Understand that we, your sisters, do this out of respect for the truth of your testimony. Understand that we do this out of love and dedication, that we acknowledge the gifts of heavenly grace bestowed upon you beyond your material desires, freed of devilish contrivance or fabrication or calumny. So forgive us, dear sister, as we peel back your incorruptible skin, like petals of a flower barely touched by this morning's sun. Forgive us, dear sister, when we expose your maw, when we cover your sinews with herbs and fragrant spices, like tender young lamb ready for the fire. Please forgive us, dear sister, once we have cleaved your unkissed breast and found the evidence for God encased so securely within your miraculous, blameless heart. So that's Chiara. You can read about that story. Look it up on Wikipedia. There's a fantastic entry in Wikipedia on Chiara. And there's also the Abbey at Montefalco has still got a website up telling the whole story of Chiara and all the sisters. And the book that testimony came from is still available in some of the libraries around the place. So something else that poetry and science can do is to actually bring you some sense of explanation or experience in a way that you can't get out of a textbook and you might not get from any other way as well. So as I said, I've been in a neuroscience most of my professional career. And the neuroscience we do, Judy also worked with us, we collaborated for more than 30 years probably, on the nerves that communicate between the internal organs and the rest of the body, between the spinal cord and the guts and the blood vessels and the heart and all the rest of the stuff. So the nerves which take instructions out from the brain and the spinal cord out to the body, as well as the nerves which bring information back so your brain knows what's going on in there. Now, the good thing about that, you don't have to worry about it. It's all automatic. These nerves just usually trundle away, and most of the time, you don't know they're doing anything until something goes wrong, which luckily doesn't happen too often. But I also taught a lot of neuroscience about movement and how it interacts with the nerve system interacts with the body. And that leads on then to the neuroscience of language. And just a little bit about how all this works. And over the last 30 or 40 years, there's been a real revolution in the way in which neuroscience understand how the brain works, and especially in the processing of language. And there are a lot of remarkable things about how language is done. The first and foremost is that there's no single place in your brain which does language. So there's a division between different components of speech. So nouns and adjectives, names of things, are processed differently from the words for actions, like verbs and adverbs and things like that. you can have, if you're unfortunate enough, you can have a stroke, which will lead you just dropping out some component of your language. Where we hear and where we hear language and interpret what you're hearing is a different part of the brain to generating speech. Generating speech involves huge areas of your brain, depending on what it is you're talking about and how you're talking. I just notice out the corner of my eye as I'm talking to you, I'm waving my hands around. I'm doing this one on purpose, but from now on I won't be, unless I think of it. So you tend to, move your hands around as you're speaking without thinking about it. Whoa, how does that work? Well, there's a set of circuits which move your hands around. I'm doing this one on purpose now. In time with your speech, in time with the rhythm of your speech, pretty much automatically, and that pathway is almost the same as the speech pathway. So as I'm talking to you, how do I know what I'm going to say next? I don't know. I can't tell you that. It just happens. It just seems to happen. And there are processes deeper in the brain which seem to be important in controlling the grammar of your speech, the rhythm of your speech, and getting it out with some sort of timing, making some sort of sense. People talk about left brain versus right brain. There's lots of myths about the brain, and the left brain and the right sides of the brain definitely are different, but you can't control which ones do what. So don't waste your money, little anti-plug. Don't waste your money on these self-help things. We'll open up the right side of your brain, the missing 90%. It's all bullshit. Don't spend your money on cars or the horses or something. You're going to get better return. Books, buy books. But one thing which is known is that the left, in doing language, the left side of your brain tends to do the bit by bits, the word to word sort of meaning of the language. Right side tends to do the larger scale stuff, metaphor, ambiguity, not making, keeping track of things until something finally makes sense, you hope. So for a long time people thought people had right side damage, they could still speak okay. Yeah, they can, but they don't get jokes. And they can't keep track of a murder mystery. And if you use a metaphor or a simile, they go, huh? And all sorts of stuff like that. So there's a lot of things going on there. So one of the things which language builds into it is this notion of understanding what someone else is going to say. You're having a conversation, you're predicting what the person's going to say next. That's called partly that is theory of mind, guessing what someone else is going to say. There's a lot of stuff that language doesn't work at. And language is really, really hopeless at two things that we do all the time. And one is moving. Language is hopeless for describing actions. So if I just did that, how would you describe what I did if you're watching? Were you watching? You weren't watching. I'll just do it again. Write that down in words, and a bit of fiddling around there, so that someone else could do it exactly the way I did it. You probably couldn't. That's one thing. So, and when you have instruction manuals, no one ever reads the instructions. Why not? Because it's much easier to have a go for yourself or get someone who knows how to do it to show you. Language doesn't work. And the other thing language doesn't work at is deep emotional stress. And you have all these phrases in English, I'm sure they exist in other languages as well. I can't put into words how I feel. Words escape me. And so there's a whole industry built around that of greeting cards and stuff, sort of give you little shortcuts. You know it's not quite right, but it'll do. And then the final thing is something which drives philosophers nuts, is people argue about how much language feeds into higher level thinking. It does feed into it, there's no doubt about that. But I've got this idea, I can't find the right word for it. Or I went to bed thinking about a problem, woke up at 3 o'clock, there's the answer. So you're talking in your sleep? Nope. That idea you had, was it written down somewhere on a tablet, a little blackboard in your brain somewhere? Nope. And so there's a lot of cognitive activity which goes on which is non-verbal. And it drives philosophers nuts trying to work out what that means. Neuroscientists still don't know the answer either. But it's absolutely clear that a lot of high-level thinking is non-verbal as well. So, what can poetry do about this? I said poetry can describe the indescribable. I've already given you some examples, maybe. I mean, sharks can't talk. I gave you a point of view of a shark. What might it be like to experience something that you don't know? One thing would be What would it be like not to have an arm? Phantom limb. So people have lose an arm, they still experience it in some sort of way. How might you experience that? What that might like that feel like? Now, people have tried to describe it, but they can't. So one argument is that we all feel, it's what it always feels like. It's what that feels like. So this is from Lessons in Neuroscience, Lesson 1, Phantom Limb. The space between my hands, like whiskey-tongued fishermen, shore-bound by force 10 gales, I dream about the ones which got away. Snapper, mulloway, ocean trout, hammerhead, fins slicing the sea into sashimi, carpaccio, butterfly fillets, jettisoned, spinning and flipping and floating far away from any dimly recollected grasp. The gaps between my fingers, as if they were feathers, as if they should span the imbalance dividing this updraft from that. This diminishing shadow from its source, this invisible calculation defining lift and drag, streamlined flight and unrecoverable freefall from this total, irredeemable loss of sensibility. The space between my hands, the gaps between my fingers. Only now can I describe the shapes that fill my memory. Only now can I describe the holdfasts, the hefts, the weights, the locks and latches, the keys mislaid forever. Only now can I describe for you a tattoo needle, a wedding ring, collisions, inadequate light, irredeemable, unbidden, insufficient narcosis. So that's just about it. Lots more here. I've got poems about libraries and we've got stuff about other stuff. So I finish up with something from our latest project. This is the microscope project, which has been going on for 2 years now. It's now open at the Flinders Gallery collaborative project with Catherine Truman, Deb Jones, Angela Valamanesh, and Nicholas Verland, who's the Sala featured artist this year, which is a stroke of luck for us. This is based on a suite of microscopes that we decommissioned and decided to do something useful with rather than throw out. So we turned them into art. And one of the final bit of that art, of that poetry and science, is this huge resource of materials that science has in terms of all the texts. And so I've plundered the text, the manuals, the brochures and things like that, to produce a series of texts for how things work. And so this is a poetry book. It's not like most you've seen. It's got lots of, it's all in colour and it's been illustrated by artists and stuff like that. So I'll just finish off with a section from this, which is where it gets the title from. Got a minute or two? Have we gone for time? Yep. So this is from a selection from How Things Work. Monday morning. This is how it works. First, you must plug it in, obviously. Switch on the power, ramp up the voltage, check the vacuum status. You rehearse the operating procedures, the protocols required for your session. But you may as well be on the moon, holding your breath, lest oxygen supply drops below empty. You peer into the squid ink sky, your feet aglow with dry volcanic dust, just trying to keep your hands out of trouble. Are you alone? Did you notice the rusted door hinge in need of oil? Did it creak? Better then to ensure your notebook is open, blue lined at a blank page, your pen refilled at the ready. Because you never know when the next vital message will arrive. Incommunicado? Nah, not on hope in hell. Which, once all is said and done, is another possible location. It's hot. Sparks fly at a moment's notice. The atmosphere, such as it is, seems to be haunted by chimeras and cynocephalics and twin-fanged vipers. So what's next? Same as before. Catch your breath. Be alert. Wednesday, dark. This is how it works. Like a whisper, when she rests her arm lank across my own, kisses the nape of my neck, sweeps my hair from her eyes. Until he might dream of tropical waves rippling our ankle shadows, until he imagined row after row of thunderheads rebuilding our horizons. Later, it's soaring saxophones and hi-hat cymbals and a rhythm too flexible for us to grasp. while my pulse races towards an unrecognized target, 3 beats at a time. And again she whispers, a hint, a clue. Should I log the days I miss, record the objects I fail to see, the items I place absentmindedly to one side? Softly she laughs, and I hesitate. Is there something else I shall consider? A button to press, a gauge to read? Her voice remains insistent beside my ear, veils the flickering screen, draws all I think I understand into a single point of anticipation. Monday afternoon. Yeah, this is how it works. You cop it on the chin, roll with the punches, take the occasional standing count. Nothing comes easy. How could anyone reckon otherwise? The odds are stacked against you. Them and us, rich versus poor. It's common bloody knowledge, common bloody sense. Strangers turn up out of nowhere, disappear from the face of the earth. You haven't got much chance when the chips are down. Apart from your mates, of course. But who can you trust? Who do you want to listen to once money becomes involved? Under the counter, on the sly, it's a dirty business. Shout a few rounds down the pub, you'll twig soon enough. Front bar or back, everyone will agree, 100%. Sorry, what was that? The question, how microscopes work? Sorry, not my area. I haven't the slightest idea. So that's a good place to stop, I reckon. Thank you.
We have about 5 minutes for questions, so would anyone like to?
You mentioned that there were a couple of things, I'm not sure that I remember them properly, I think one was to do with instructions, that language is very poor at. Is there, well, presumably we have music as something that communicates with one part of our being, the visual arts, the expressive arts, poetry. And we have language, but is there a part of our being that cannot be properly communicated in any way, properly communicated, that it would be great if somehow we could find a way that it could be properly communicated?
I reckon the answer to that's yes. I mean, it's one of the questions which comes up in modern neuroscience, which has fluctuated a lot, and it comes to the notion of what consciousness is. And over the 30-odd years I've been in neuroscience, my own opinions on whether or not that's an answerable question has swayed dramatically a lot. I mean, 20 years ago I thought we had no hope of figuring out half of this stuff, but a lot of stuff has been figured out. And there's a lot of amazing information out there. But I still... I worked at a cellular level, how cells work, connect to each other. We know lots about that. It's going to be very difficult to understand how you get from that to the sort of global feeling. And one of the things I don't think anybody would ever be able to explain what it feels like to be you. You know what it feels like, and it can change depending how you feel. So if you're feeling grumpy or sad, is that still the same you? Yes, but it feels different. And... Right. People can have brain damage where their sense of self is seriously perturbed. I don't mean just their feeling of, you know, maybe feeling depressed or something like that, or their sense of social worth, but the actual feeling for their body becomes perturbed. So they'll disown part of their body, for example. So no one can explain that feeling, though you can see the consequences of it.
Right, but there'd be presumably enough commonality between people to be able to identify if someone's angry or sad,
yeah.
But the subtlety, yeah, I take your point. Yeah. We can't exactly know, can we?
Your last point's a very good one, because there's a good example of that for something that one of our areas of research and used to teach is pain, is what's going on with the neuroscience of pain. And, okay... Here's a little excerpt from the standard teaching example. Had stabbing pain, yep. Shooting pain, yep. Ever been stabbed or shot? So how do we know what we're talking about? It turns out what people as far as you can tell, when people talk about stabbing pains or shooting pains, they're different, and people use those words in a similar enough way that a skilled practitioner, a doctor or someone in a pain clinic knows what you're talking about. When you talk to people what it feels like to be shot and stabbed on the assumption they've survived it, it's not a stabbing or a shooting pain. So that's a lovely example. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm trying to wrap my brains around realising that the invention of new technology on certain levels, whether professionally or to the civilian population, can change everything hitherto known or described. For instance, when I sometimes jokingly think of Charles Darwin's trip with the Beagle Boys and always wonder why he never went back with any notion of, you know, why the kangaroo's chest is about the closest thing to a man's chest that you can see in the animal kingdom, let alone its behaviour. And the same going for what I would like to call the collective mindsets and how collective mindsets change or have to change or are suppressed from changing at the time they ought to change. Like the thylacine in Tasmania came at a time when the thin red line was decimating everything that was black or had a thylacine jaw. Mm. And yet that was the crucial difference that made a difference. I'm not sure if I, you know where
it is. So I think that the first bit of the question about technology and is in the, how that affects science and what's regarded as valid and what's not is again a very good question. To a large degree, science, the advancements in science have been driven by technological innovation. And often the technology comes first and then the new science comes. Sometimes it works the other way around as well. Sometimes people are trying to ask a particular question, they know they don't have the technology, people try and invent, you know, a better microscope or a better telescope or a better this or that or something like that. But often those, as people talk about all the time, those technological innovations sort of move sideways and sometimes they're hanging around there for ages. So the last work I was doing at Flinders over the last couple of years before I retired is using technology that was patented in the 60s. No one could figure out how to actually make it commercially until the 1980s. And it really wasn't until 10 years ago that those sorts of instruments became widely available. And those instruments let you do things that you couldn't have done otherwise. Therefore, you see stuff you couldn't have done otherwise. And you discover things that you didn't even know were discoverable 20 years ago. And that changes the way you think about stuff. And that can happen, there's lots of examples of that in the history of science. Now, does that mean that all the stuff that went beforehand was wrong? No, some of it probably was, but a lot of it stays the same. So people sometimes have this notion that science is always turning over and you have these old ideas. No, it sort of roils around the edges, but the core just keeps on solidifying. So all the chemistry that I learnt in 1972, that's all the basic chemistry is still true, but there's a whole lot more stuff there as well. When I was doing biology in the early 70s, people had only just discovered DNA. And now, some of the ideas they had then were wrong, but DNA is still the important thing. So ideas do change, there's no doubt about that, but there's a core which just keeps moving on and being, if you like, getting bigger and stronger as more stuff happens around it. Doesn't mean you can always be proven wrong, though, if with good enough experiment or a better instrument.
Yeah, I think, Ian, your combination of science and poetry is not very common. I wonder whether you sort of have any comment in the general sense around that, whether there have been precedents. I seem to remember reading somewhere that Galileo wrote a few sonnets, but I don't know of any other. I also wonder whether that's one question, but have you ever practically, for example, used a poem in your lectures or to use illumination at all, or is this a private thing for audiences like us? Or have you actually ever sort of used a poem in a lecture or a sort of scientific environment?
Answer the first question So the second question first. So over the last few years, as I got more confident and stuff's been out published, one of the things I teach embryology, and I've got a sequence which I finish up with, which is a story of a pair of conjoint twins in medieval Italy, which is a really sort of heart-wrenching story. And that's part of setting the social and political context of science. So I've done that. Most scientific conferences, you have time to spend even 3 minutes on a poem. But I've at seminars and stuff, some of these ones on imagining neurological conditions, I've used those in seminars when I've had more time to do that, and people seem to like it. Now, going back to how common or whatever it is, there's two quick bits to that answer. I mean, I have part of my faith in humanity is that most people, if given half a chance, can do some sort of art. Maybe they don't want to do it professionally at a high craft level, but most people, if given a bit of a chance, can do music. Most people, given a bit of a chance, can draw. Most people, given a bit of a chance, can do some form of creative writing, even if it's just writing a letter. That's a creative process. Every time you speak, most of the time anyway, you're making up new words as you go along. You're not usually have all everything you said pre-rehearsed. So that's not to trivialise it, but just to indicate that how deep it is in it. So, and scientists are no different from that. Not too many scientists are writers in creative writing sense, but a lot of musicians, and it's pretty common. If you go to a meeting of 100 scientists in a room like this, and if it's the right context, you're just as likely to end up with 3-4 people having a jam session, at 1 o'clock in the morning at some time. That's happened plenty of times. So there's nothing special about science, I don't think, but it's just that environment facilitates those sorts of interactions.
Well, I think we should bring the evening to a close. I'm sure you'll agree with me that was a very special presentation tonight, and I'd very much like to thank Ian for coming along. I thought it was both informative and very entertaining, and thank you very much, Ian. If you could join me in thanking him.
Thank you. Pleasure.